Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I always like to thank the people who support this program, and today we name Carol Krez, Michelle Pasco, Nancy Mrazek, and Bill Lackamacher. You can do it too. Go to peterbcollins.com, and our bonus book offer is still alive and well. Check it out.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from the way it used to be.
In our second segment today, we'll be joined by Professor Eli Zaretsky. His new book is called Why America Needs a Left. He's singing to me, I'll tell you. but first, our latest update on the effort to scuttle Citizens United, the onerous Supreme Court decision that puts corporate money into our political campaigns in this country. And item, the news today, Sheldon Adelson, who pumped millions of dollars into the lifeless campaign of Newt Gingrich in the primaries, has announced that he's dropping $10 million into Mitt Romney's super PAC. And so as the plutocrats play with us, we are just the little ants in their ant farm. We see just daily the evidence of the damage of Citizens United. Attorney Rob Hager returns to our program today. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Peter.
And let's just pick up here, because today is possibly a day of decision at the Supreme Court on the Montana appeal. We're speaking on Thursday, June 14th. And so I went to SCOTUS blog, and anybody can do this, SCOTUSblog.com. And I'll ask you to rate their credibility in a moment, Rob. But most of the blather right now is about the anticipated decision on the Obamacare appeal. And, you know, that does certainly garner a lot of attention for various reasons. But the issue of campaign finance is ranked second here in the Daily Post at SCOTUS blog. And it's interesting because they use the title of the suit, American Tradition Partnership Incorporated versus Bullock. And this is what we talked about at some length yesterday, the name of the case file. And should not that read versus Montana, because Bullock is simply the current attorney general of the state of Montana, and this listing makes it appear that this is a suit by a corporation against an individual, which, of course, would not be banned by the 11th Amendment.
That's right. We talked about that yesterday, and in the context of understanding how the Supreme Court rewrote the 11th Amendment in order to circumvent its constraint on suits against states being entertained in the federal courts. And so they created a legal fiction, and we know about that in this other context of corporate personhood. It's kind of famous in that context of the legal fiction of corporate personhood, is much talked about in the context of Citizens United, money and politics. But this was done much earlier to circumvent the 11th Amendment. And because of that fiction, we talked yesterday how it is essential, if you're going to try to circumvent the 11th Amendment, to pretend, use the fiction that you're suing an individual, when in fact you're suing the Attorney General of the state of Montana, which is Montana, and that is prescribed by the 11th Amendment. So that's where we begin of how the Supreme Court does rewrite the Constitution when they decide it's to their advantage or to the advantage of their benefactors or their class to do so.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm looking at the file on SCOTUS blog, which I believe reflects the Supreme Court website's listings, and it shows it as American Tradition Partnership Incorporated versus Bullock, not Western Tradition Partnership, which was the name, prior to February. Does this give us any information that is fresh or different from what we discussed yesterday, Rob? It doesn't appear so.
Not really, except I think you're right in mentioning that the Supreme Court figured out that American Tradition Partnership had changed their name since February, and then they did change the name of the case to American Tradition Partnership versus Bullock. Whereas yesterday we talked about how the first time the Bullock designation turned up for the defendant or the appellee, at the same time the court had used this old name, which had been used in the Montana Supreme Court, but had been changed during the short period between the decision in the Montana Supreme Court and the filing for a stay order in February. And so this gave rise to our suspicion that somebody had told the clerk's office way in advance of the stay order being filed what the name of the case they wanted. In other words, before the court, the only reasonable conclusion you could take is before the court actually had this case, they had already decided what the name of it should be. And because where would they have gotten this term Western Tradition Partnership from in their own filings? There was no filing in that name. The filing from the beginning in the U.S. Supreme Court was American Tradition Partnership. So it's good to point out that after their initial mistake of calling it Western Tradition Partnership, they did convert that, again, on their own. So they changed the name of the case twice, basically.
Well, and that actually triggers a memory on my part. A few years back, there was quite a controversy over a case in Pennsylvania regarding the insertion of so-called intelligent design into public high school curricula as opposed to evolution or, you know, in addition to evolution. And what became apparent after the court reviewed the briefs was that a filing that came from the Discovery Institute, a conservative think tank in Seattle that has involved itself in a number of right-wing fringe causes, they had filed a brief where somebody went through and using the power of Microsoft Word, they changed the term creationism to intelligent design repeatedly throughout the document. And the court, I guess a clerk or somebody's kid, went through the file and said, look at this. They did a find and replace. And it was used by the court to basically pull back the curtain and show that there was no difference on the part of the appellant there between creationism and intelligent design. And that was a critical issue because they were arguing that there was a difference between creationism and intelligent design.
I think the difference that they would have argued is that, well, creationism is a religious point of view.
Right.
And so they'd have separation of state problems if they're trying to impose their religious views. But intelligent design, on the other hand, is a scientific term that scientists use. They have a lot of phony science to support that.
Yeah.
I remember, I think there's been a book written, actually, describing how that intelligent design movement got started, and it was really just all the same religious people who were promoting it.
Right.
But decided they needed some cover.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe there's some Sharpie there inside the Supreme Court clerk's office who might discover a find and replace in terms of this particular case. Now, again, looking at the listing at SCOTUS blog, there are a number of amicus briefs. Citizens United filed one, Chamber of Commerce, Mitch McConnell, that defender of free speech and fair elections, ACLU in support of neither party. Retired Supreme Court justices of the Montana Court and Sheldon Whitehouse and John McCain filed a brief together. They're both members of the U.S. Senate. And toward the bottom here, we have the 11th Amendment movement. So It's very clear that the brief calling for invocation of the 11th Amendment, which would cause the court to decline to hear the case at all, it is on file.
Oh, yeah. And it was docketed as of May 18th.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So we're in the game, and from what we know, and the court works in very secretive, murky ways, but today is probably the day, Rob, that the justices are reviewing these documents and deciding how to handle this case?
They will. I was told by the clerk's office that they will vote on the case today, but that vote could be no more than, gee, we don't have enough time for this. Let's take it up at our next conference next week. So, but they will address it in some way.
So it's on an agenda or a docket?
It is on the agenda, yeah, for their conference.
Okay. And typically, you know, when do we learn of the proceedings of a conference like this?
Well, the earliest would be probably not even today, but maybe tomorrow if they actually take some action that might get up on the docket. The Supreme Court. The Supreme Court maintains a docket for the case, so everything that happens in the case shows up on that docket. It's the history of the case, and so it could happen as early as tomorrow. But normally, it would be Monday when they announce their, you know, their decision. So mm-hmm. I would not look for it before Monday, really. But I know I probably will look for it tomorrow, just out of curiosity to see if anything actually unusual did happen. And I wouldn't expect it till Monday, though.
And yesterday we talked about the sorry loss of credibility of this court as it's become more and more political, more and more results-oriented. And push me back here if I'm too cynical, Rob, but is there the possibility here that they'll do a 1-2 where they'll make the dramatic pronouncement about the Obamacare appeal, which, of course, has been through unprecedented multiple days of oral argument and is the focal point of this term. Do you think that they might release it and this appeal decision at the same time in an effort to downplay and reduce coverage of the challenge to Citizens United?
I think that that might be the most clever thing they could do, actually. I think you've defined. Now, I'm not sure that they would be all that clever to do it, but they usually are. I actually consider the Supreme Court to be more in the business of public relations than they are really in the business of rule of law. What the Supreme Court's function in recent years is to try to justify extreme right-wing policies and to put the best twist on them and tie them into some constitutional provision or some legal provision. But this is not really rule of law in the sense of professional judges just trying to follow the law as it's written. You know, these are justices with a political agenda, and they are pretty clever. So I would not at all put them past doing just what you described. And I would say that although the Health Care Act, of course, has, because it's very political and it's kind of inside Washington stuff, affects the outcome of the elections and so forth, it definitely has gotten the most attention. And it's also, I have to also concede that, you know, the legal issue is a very interesting and important legal issue, too, is how far can Congress go under the Commerce Clause. But I would say that in terms of its long-term consequences that we're going to be living with for some time, that the Montana case is actually a more important case, and that the Supreme Court would understand that, and that would be a reason why they would use what you described as cynical, but I would just describe as being a kind of prescient of how the court operates, and they may want to bury what they do in the Montana case beneath the great deal of publicity that obviously the Health Care Act case is going to get.
Yeah. Now, one of the other things that we've discussed also with your colleague before the bar, Carl Mayer, is the issue of how serious Democratic politicians are about overturning Citizens United. And what we're seeing, at least rhetorically, is an emphasis on the amend the Constitution approach. And I certainly don't oppose that. And friends of mine have been involved with a group called Move to Amend, and many people who I have deep respect for have put their energies into marshaling forces for a constitutional amendment. But it is so difficult to achieve that, and my concern is that if you start the process either at the state level or more problematically with a constitutional convention, that any effort to amend the Constitution could go sideways. And a lot of right-wing, at least what I consider to be dangerous ideas, might be embraced and put forward as constitutional amendments. So tell me your thoughts about the most expedient and effective way of dispatching the Citizens United decision. Is it through this current challenge, or is it through the long haul of amending the Constitution?
Okay, that's a very good question. It's a big question. You may want to break it down by interrupting me as I proceed here.
All right.
But I'll start out by saying that there are theoretically, within our Constitution, there are at a theoretical level, there are only three ways to deal with Citizens United that don't involve changing the composition of the court itself. In other words, what can we do right now with the current composition of the court? And they derive from the structure of the Constitution, which, as I've mentioned earlier in our first discussion, I think that, you know, Madison is responsible for this dividing what we call federal and state. He called dual sovereignty. We often refer to this as states' rights, but the Constitution does create, in primarily the 11th Amendment, a state's right to have a separate sovereignty from the United States. And the purpose of that was to prevent a unitary tyranny from being imposed on the country. And I would say that that is exactly the condition we're in right now, with not just Citizens United, but the whole line of cases that we refer to as Citizens United. But it started back in 1976 with Buckley v. Beliau, and it continues to move forward. Last year, there was an Arizona case that was even worse than Citizens United, and it just continues. It's this whole line of cases that come under the title of money and politics and derive from this notion that money equals speech.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first way that we've been describing is the 11th Amendment, and to separate states out from the federal government, allow states to write their own laws, and not to allow the Supreme Court to impose their views of the Constitution on the states in this area, which involves the core sovereignty of the states and does not implicate the 14th Amendment's issues of discrimination on the basis of gender or race and so forth. So, mm-hmm. you know, issues that don't involve that, that the Supreme Court on its own cannot tell a state how to manage its elections. Okay, the second theoretical way of proceeding is to look at the separation of powers, which is the other way Madison divided up power to avoid tyranny. And at the federal level, we have the three branches of government, two of them elected and the Supreme Court appointed. And at that level, the founders realized that a Supreme Court, and Madison spoke directly to this, that the Supreme Court could actually be the branch that tries to impose tyranny on the country. He spoke directly to that, and so they dealt with that by giving Congress the power to define almost all of the Supreme Court's jurisdiction. They reserved to them a very narrow area that they called their original jurisdiction, mm-hmm. which actually involved suits against states primarily, but a few others too, but not very important and definitely not germane to this issue. This issue comes up to the Supreme Court. They get to decide to overthrow McCain-Feingold under their appellate jurisdiction, not under their original jurisdiction. And Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2, Sentence 2, known as the Exceptions Clause of the Constitution, provides that Congress can pass a simple law that makes an exception to the appellate jurisdiction of the court. Generally thought that by constitutional scholars that all of the appellate jurisdiction of the court is actually granted to it by Congress. At the very outset, the first law that gave Supreme Court jurisdiction withheld from the Supreme Court all criminal jurisdiction and criminal appeals, for an example. And that power has been used many times since then. And so what we are actually advocating is that Congress use that power. Now, the third approach is a constitutional amendment. And if you analyze all the constitutional amendments and you extract out the actually four instances when a constitutional amendment was passed to overturn a Supreme Court decision, there's only one situation that is similar to the Citizens United case, where we have a Supreme Court decision that is not supported by the states It's not supported by Congress. It's not supported by any president we've had since the law was passed, you know, that got overturned by Citizens United. George Bush signed the law. Obama was very clearly and expressly against the decision. So when the Supreme Court is sitting all alone, the only analogy to this situation we're in now is actually the 11th Amendment. That was the case when the 11th Amendment was passed, is that the whole country was opposed to both parties, both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, all the states and Congress got busy very quickly to overturn that decision by a constitutional amendment. Now, the reason why they had to do it by a constitutional amendment in that case was because it did come up under the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction, which is something the Supreme Court has that is basically their own. No one can touch that. But if that case had come up as under their appellate jurisdiction, Congress could have just stripped the power of the court under, by a simple law. They wouldn't have needed a constitutional amendment. Now, what's instructive about the 11th Amendment, when we do compare it with the proposals to try to solve Citizens United through passing a constitutional amendment, is that what happened to the 11th Amendment was that the court came up with this fiction that we've been talking about to basically repeal it by interpretation. And that repealer has been in effect for a long time. It's receding gradually, and this case is attempting to give it just another little nudge, but not too much of a nudge, because we feel we can win this case even within the current cases, because, and the reason why, is that we're only looking for one judge or one justice.
Right.
We don't need all five to agree with us to win on this issue. But if we needed to get all five, we'd have to give it a little nudge, we think. But we don't really have to give it a nudge in this case because, as I say, we're only looking for one. So if you look at the analogy between what happened to the 11th Amendment and what would likely happen to any constitutional amendment that attempts to regulate money in politics, we're likely going to have these five justices decide what that amendment means. And the problem with any amendment, and you may notice this, that there's actually no text. With the last major amendment effort in America, you probably recall this, was the ERA, Rights Amendment for Women. And that was a very simple, straightforward statement that I don't know if I could actually, I could probably paraphrase it right now. But there was nothing contentious about the text of the amendment itself.
Right.
It said what it meant. It meant what it said. Everybody knew what it meant, and you're either for it or against it. You know.
Yep.
The trouble with this amendment that's being proposed is there's actually no text that anybody agrees on, and there's a reason for that. Is that there's no way to actually easily describe the policies that people would agree to about money in politics. This is inherently a legislative matter. It will require a rather complex, in fact, I like to use the metaphor of the Patriot Act. You know, the Patriot Act is the effort by the government to impose a kind of a police state on Americans. And what we need to do is actually, we need to impose a kind of a police state on the 1% who are corrupting our elections. We need a law that is almost that big and that complex in order to address this issue. Constitutional amendments don't look like that.
Now I like your analogy there. Would that give me a national security letter that I could just take and impose on any rich fat cat I want?
Well, actually, the way it's drafted, we actually have a draft of this, the law that we're, a concept draft of the law that we would promote to do this. And in fact, we do. In that law is actually a authorization for a person, anybody, to serve as a private attorney general to bring suits against anybody who's guilty of violating the money in politics, you know, anti-money in politics law. We like to call it the Granny D. Haddock Act. After you may remember the woman who walked across the country, you know,
yeah,
campaign finance reform. Well, she died just within a week or so after Citizens United was decided. We thought it would be a good memorial to her to name a law that would be a comprehensive law to get money out of politics. And that's what we think is needed. The constitutional amendment has the problem that you mentioned, that it requires two-thirds of Congress and it requires three-quarters of the states to approve.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing. But that's not the worst thing about it. The worst thing is that it simply hands back to, and I can actually quote, there's a guy who was the former FEC commissioner. He was actually the chair of the FEC, a guy named, if I have the name right, Trevor Potter.
Mm-hmm.
And Colbert has hired him to be his lawyer. You know Colbert.
Oh, yeah, I have seen him there. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so he actually has a very good quote. He says, you know, the problem with the constitutional amendment is first what I said. It's very hard to draft, and I would say it's actually impossible to draft. Because you can't do it with the complexity necessary to solve the problem, and then you're dealing with just a partial solution rather than a full solution. And when you have that kind of abstraction, you're leaving too much interpretation to the court, and that's what he said. He said, you're just putting this right back in the hands of the people who created the problem, and when we have the view of the court that's as realistic as you and I share about who these guys are, they are perfectly capable of taking any constitutional amendment and actually using it to empower themselves to have a say in about money and politics. As the Constitution is now written, and as it was intended by the framers, who said that, look, we have written a Constitution in which rich people can have no outside say. They just get one vote like everybody else. You know, we do not permit any property requirements to exercise the vote or run for office, and so we have drafted a constitution here that does not allow the rich people to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they thought they had done, and they were right up until the 20th century when we started using electronic communications and we started to learn about propaganda techniques and we started employing them. By mid-century, they were both pretty well developed. And, of course, this doctrine came along in 76 to unleash money in politics, and since then it's been all downhill.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're looking at is that the constitutional amendment, just to summarize, is the constitutional amendment is the least effective and probably counterproductive way to address the problem.
Well,
probably counterproductive. In other words, I'm saying that as the Constitution is now written, the Supreme Court actually has no role to play. They have usurped a role, and the only reason they've gotten away with it is because that by corrupting Congress, Congress has been supine and has failed to take action. However, if the people could get enough power to force Congress to do anything like pass a constitutional amendment, they could actually solve the whole problem with the same political energy by forcing Congress to pass a law that would, A, remove the Supreme Court's jurisdiction over this area of law, just this area, and, two, enact a comprehensive law that will get money out of politics and will actually do it completely. I'll add one more point. I'm sorry I cut you off just a minute ago. I wanted to finish that point, but I'll just add one more point, is that a lot of people don't understand. And my last job, actually, for the United Nations, I'll mention here, was writing a long book-length report on how to deal with corruption in the justice sector in Afghanistan.
Mm.
And when we started out that job, the idea was that we'll just try to just give us a few ideas. We can tinker around and sort of make things better. And as I did more and more research and tried to write this report, I realized, well, every study shows that when you have a systematically corrupt government, you know, not just, you know, what's called petty corruption,
mm-hmm.
right? People, you know, taking a little backsheesh here and there, as they call it over there. But when it's systematically corrupt, every decision is corrupt by money, which is what we have here in the United States. We all know that. We know that every decision that involves the power of, and the profits of the 1% is corrupted by their money. Every decision. We don't have. I have a standing challenge for someone to debate me over if they know of one that doesn't apply to. But every single area that we deal with, I won't list them all. They're too long. Is corrupted. So we have a systematically corrupt government. That in that situation, partial reforms do more harm than good.
Well, they just shift who's greasing whom, but the grease remains.
Exactly.
Well, a couple of things, Rob. One is that again, I am not opposed to those who put their energies into a constitutional amendment, but you have further sobered any expectations I might have about that process. And I've known Nancy Pelosi for many years, and she's a complicated person. We have a kind of complicated relationship. I support a lot of her ideals, and I deplore many of her practical moves, including I can never forgive her for, quote-unquote, taking impeachment off the table.
Totally agree. That's my first complaint against her.
But recently I saw her give an interview where she articulated that Citizens United is this this toxic decision that will further corrupt our politics, and that you know, she was encouraging people to support a constitutional amendment. Now, at the same time, I've just received an email inviting me to a fundraiser for Nancy Pelosi. And for a $5,000 ticket, I can get a private dinner with Ms. Pelosi and a front row seat for the Mickey Hart Band and special guest DJ MC Hammer. And she would argue, if she were here right now, oh, Peter, you know, we cannot unilaterally disarm. And Peter, she would say, Peter, you just pointed out that Sheldon Adelson is putting $10 million into Mitt Romney's super PAC, and so we can't just sit back and do nothing. But Pelosi has raised hundreds of millions of dollars since she became the Democratic leader in the House.
Oh, yeah.
And it has been used to elect blue dogs, conservative Democrats who she couldn't count on to deliver even on moderate proposals. And it really underscores your point that, and this is a point that I heard from Ted Rall, the cartoonist who was on with us last week, that any kind of reform will really only make things worse and muddy the waters further. And yet, I don't believe that most Americans are ready for any dramatic revolutionary changes, whether it involves going to the streets or taking up arms in the Second Amendment remedy that Sharon Angle so beautifully presented for
us. Good way to characterize that.
And so how do we direct our energies, Rob? This case, you know, before the court right now seems to be one that offers some promise, but given the way the court operates and the appropriate cynicism we have about that, it just seems like every way we turn, we're fucked.
Well, remember that the reason why this was not actually a very effective strategy, as I said, that I thought I gave it at least a 50-50 chance of actually succeeding in overturning Citizens United, which is pretty good odds when you think of these people who are promoting a constitutional amendment, which is sometime off in the by and by, you know, decade from now, some of them are saying maybe this will happen. And we're talking about a 50-50 shot. Remember that this was undermined by Democrats, who did not pursue this strategy of getting basically 50 state attorney generals to go knock on the door, metaphorically, of the Supreme Court and say, we have states' rights and we want you to follow the 11th Amendment, you know, to a T. Mm-hmm. You follow the 11th Amendment, you leave Montana alone, you leave all of us alone on this issue. Now, we couldn't get them to do that because, not because the Republicans said no, it was because the Democrats refused to do that. Now, why would the Democrats refuse to do that? Same reason Nancy Pelosi is supporting a constitutional amendment and other Democrats are supporting a constitutional amendment, because that will never happen. They can take the very nice position that they're against money in politics, and at the same time, they can take more money than Republicans take, which is generally what's true, although this year it looks like the Republicans will get more than Democrats.
Yeah.
But on an average year, Democrats raise more money than Republicans. They're as deep into this corrupt system as Republicans are. But they get to pretend they're not, and the Republicans don't have to pretend that they're not in favor of money in politics.
Good point.
So that's what we're dealing with. That's what the Constitutional Amendment is about. What is the solution? I just happened to hear of. I haven't looked at it, and I haven't heard him talk about it, but our former great governor, Jesse Ventura, I'm up here in Minnesota as we talk, has written a new book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really about that both parties are the problem. Both parties. And I would say if you really drill down as deep as you can go, what is the problem that we have? It is the allegiance that people hold to these two parties, which I look at as no more than actually the union for corrupt politicians. And they have two locals. One local is the Democrats, and one local is the Republicans. They both are totally corrupt. They're not going to change the system. You can vote for them all you want, you know. And of course, all they ask you to do is you're not really voting for them. You're usually just voting your fear against the other side.
Right.
But the truth is they're both the same side. So to get money out of politics, and here's my, we could talk at length, but just to raise, you know, the issue here, to get money out of politics will require that people finally give up on these two parties. And remember, only a minority of people are still in that system of believing that the independents just reached a record at 38%. You know, that's the highest in recent times. So you have to give up on these two parties that they're going to solve the problem. They're not. And you have to vote what I call single-issue voting. You vote this issue, which means you're basically voting to kick the bums out from whatever party they are. You kick them all out, and you insist that the only condition under which you will vote for an incumbent, the only condition, is if they will endorse the comprehensive legislation that will rein in the power of the court over this and get money out of politics, credibly get money out. In other words, we have to actually focus on this as our first issue. And the reason for doing that, for most of us who are deeply involved in following what the government does and who know that as I said earlier, that money determines all the outcomes that are of interest to the 1%, and that's most of the outcomes that are of interest to everybody else. I was just listening to Joseph Stiglitz, who is a very, very interesting conversation with him, actually.
Nobel Prize-winning economist. Uh-huh.
Yeah, about inequality and the growing inequality and increasing it. And it's just going to keep on going. There's no factor that's going to change the money and politics system we have that is transferring wealth. Just the figures came out yesterday, transferring wealth from the bottom 90% to the top 10%, but primarily to the top 1% and top 0.1%, basically.
Yeah.
And that's the system we have. Just going to continue. It's not going to stop until people actually realize that what they've been doing, that old definition of insanity, that it is insane to continue supporting these two parties. And the thing to do is to kick them all out and to insist that the only condition they get to keep their job is if they put as a priority and do nothing else but, they do nothing else but address the issue of money in politics. They don't change taxes. They don't do anything. They change money in politics. Because once they do that and we get our democracy back, all those other problems have their solutions all ready to go. You know, they can be solved. They can be ticked off. We'll have a democracy again. You can tick off the problem of whatever your favorite problem, financial regulation, taxes, whatever it may be, war. War is the same thing. It's driven by war profiteering. It's not driven by foreign policy. And so, you know, if we can all get together and solve this problem of money and politics, get our democracy back, I think all those other problems, and climate change being at the top of the list, of course, I need to mention that, or else we do not have a happy future ahead of us.
Well, on that note, Rob, I'm going to wrap up here, and I don't know exactly what I should go do, but something dramatic that doesn't...
Well, you've been doing it, Peter. I totally admire you.
Something dramatic that doesn't involve hurting myself.
you've been focusing on this issue very intelligently, and you're doing your share.
Okay.
Okay.
Rob, thank you for joining us again today. Rob Hager, attorney at law. This just in, our stand-up comic sit-down satirist Will Durst has a commentary for you just before the end of this podcast, and it's about money in politics, so stand by for that. But first, we're going to talk with Professor Eli Zaretsky about his new book, Why America Needs a Left.
I saw a blinding flash of light, so I pulled over to the first church on the right.
And I feel so good,
ain't no doubt about it.
I saw a bum on the curb today. Hey, well, I hit the gas and covered him with gutter spray, and I feel so good.
Feel so good about
no
it.
Doubt.
Ain't no doubt about
wanna
it.
Laugh
wanna laugh
and shout about
it.
Because I once was a liberal, but I ain't no liberal no more.
It's folk from the Clinton era, folk music from the Four Men, Ain't No Liberal No More. And I was fascinated when I received a copy of Eli Zaretsky's new book, Why America Needs a Left, A Historical Argument, partly because of the cover art. They set it up so that the text looks like it's being clipped by the left margin. And Professor Zaretsky, thank you for joining us today. I was once the subject of a billboard advertising campaign for my lefty radio show, and the phrase said, Peter B. Collins, he's a little to the left. And to accentuate that, they cut off my picture right down the middle and pushed it to the left margin.
Right.
So when I saw this, I said, ah, somebody's got the right idea. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you have been studying the American left.
Well, I'm a product, really, of the 1960s. One thing that really influenced me in the 60s were meeting older people who stressed the continuity of the left in American history and its diversity. And they went back to the abolitionists and the feminists and the socialists and so forth, that, you know, it was a very rich tradition. So I'm an American historian. I've actually worked on a variety of things. I'm maybe best known for a book called Capitalism, the Family and Personal Life. I've also written a social and cultural history of psychoanalysis. But I've always had this idea of the left as a kind of, especially the American left, as a rich and diverse tradition. And the more I saw the way the country was going, the more I felt that I had to put this idea out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're a professor of history at the New School for Social Research.
Yep.
Where else have you taught?
I've taught at the University of Missouri. I've taught at San Francisco State. Those would be the main places.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, if you'll indulge me, I would like to start at the end of your book and work backward, because we cover news and politics on a current basis.
Right.
And I'd be happy for you to weave in some of the historical threads as we talk about current and recent events.
Sure.
And you close your book with a very powerful piece, then, and I want to read part of it in a second here, about the Occupy movement. And we're speaking here on the 14th of June. And I got an email this morning from David DeGraw. He is a New Yorker who was one of the early people exposing the fraud on Wall Street, to the disparities in wealth. And he sent an email to me and many others today. Happy one-year anniversary to Anonymous 99 and End the System of Political Bribery. It was a year ago today that Anonymous and the 99% movement launched a collaborative effort in Zuccotti Park and 22 other locations nationwide to announce the birth of a decentralized, nonviolent resistance movement to end the system of political bribery. That's the campaign finance issues we were discussing in our first segment about Citizens United, and break up the big banks centered at the Federal Reserve. And you offer a real strong endorsement of the Occupy movement as an extension of the American left. You write, given the fact that Occupy Wall Street has already transformed the discourse of American politics, nothing could be more harmful than for the movement to be reabsorbed into the neoliberal, corporate-dominated Democratic Party. Instead, its goal should be to recreate a permanent radical presence in American life. And you go on, and I think this is worth quoting, Professor, because it's very powerful. For that to happen, progressives, liberals, feminists, ecology activists, gay liberationists, pacifists, anti-war activists, as well as Occupy Wall Street militants, have to reaffirm their common identity as a left. The consolidation and clarification of identity is central to every founding. It is what the abolitionists did when they got started, what the socialists did when they got started, and what the new left back in the 60s did when it got started. Like our predecessors, today's activists need to know themselves as a left, as part of an indispensable tradition. So I think that is really important, because most of us don't have a deep sense of history, particularly of political movements. And I learned a lot from your book about the 19th century, also about the 20th century, and that the New Deal was not the only political movement of its time. That's kind of what revisionist history gives us. So tell me a little bit about your thoughts about Occupy and the current state of the left, often derided by Obama and his handlers as the professional left.
Well, yeah. I thought Occupy was a great moment. I know a lot of the young people who were in Zuccotti Park and, you know, teaching at the New School was a center for Occupy Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was great partly because the Obama presidency, his campaign for the nomination was so powerful because he articulated not really the idea of a left, but of what I think is basic to the idea of a left, as I develop it in the book, and that is the idea that the country is at a turning point, that we can't go on in the old way, that we really need not just this reform or that reform, but a fundamentally new order, and that to get at that order, we have to really question who we are as a people. And when we do that, we need a very deep conception of equality, of equal freedom amongst ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the moments when our history is really punctuated by the eruption of the left. And I thought in 2008, when I supported Obama, it seemed to me that this was such a moment. When the Obama presidency didn't materialize in that direction, when it came up with, you know, taking seriously what he had said, what I thought was brilliant politics when he ran, namely that he's going to try and reach out to the Republicans, but I thought he meant reach out to the Republicans on the basis of something transformational, not on the basis of, well, we'll just go halfway. Then we had a disappointing couple of years, and I thought that Occupy Wall Street, in its radicalism and in its articulation of the issue of class and the articulation, the concept of the 99% and the 1% was so profound. I thought it was wonderful. It's also true that Occupy Wall Street is a movement of young people, to a great extent, we've lost touch with our history. And so I've written the book partly to try and fill that gap.
And have you found any readers among Occupy encampments? Because I do think that one of the interesting facets of Occupy is their unwillingness to be rushed into action, into proposing specific legislation,
right,
and a desire to really review the whole picture, try to build consensus, as difficult as that is,
right,
but based on solid information and not simply speculation. And while I've attended a couple of Occupy meetings, and I find them frustrating because everybody gets a voice. At the same time, that is a fundamental shift that I think represents an important expression.
Right. No, I agree with you. I don't know whether I've been able to find readers among the young people in Occupy Wall Street. I've had a very strong and positive response to my book. It was excerpted in These Times. The excerpt was on Real Clear Politics. There were a lot of things like that. But whether I'm actually reaching the young activists, I don't know. But I think what is important to bring out about these young people, the slogan 99% versus 1%, that's really at the core of the social democratic left, the left that was produced in the 30s and 40s, and that really goes back to the 19th century. It's a critique of capitalism and the way in which capitalism, whatever good it brings, and it does bring good, also necessarily brings injustice and needs remediation. But The Occupy Wall Street folks are also the product of the new left, and it it's the new left that I see all the time, where they won't be rushed, where they want to deliberate, where everybody has to have a voice, where they're not going to play by the rules of the game, they're not going into the politics. I mean, I think that's great. It's participatory democracy. And they also go back to the abolitionists, who were, in my argument, the first American left, in the sense that they were the first minority that really didn't deal so much with the practicalities of everyday politics, but actually tried to take a deeper, long-term view of who we were as a people and what was really fundamental to us as a people. And for them, that was racial equality, not just the abolition of slavery. So I see Occupy Wall Street as very much in the history of the American left. But it definitely it has to move from an Occupy movement to other forms of left activity, especially, I don't really talk about this in the book, but I have in other places, things like teach-ins, which is kind of occupation of intellectual space, and I think we should have demonstrations at the Democratic Convention that call for 99 seats to represent the 99%.
Professor, one of the challenges of even writing about the left in America today is that we have a jaundiced definition.
Right.
And in the era of Fox News, where Obama is called a leftist, a socialist,
right.
And these things are flatly untrue, they're an insult to anybody, and there's a lot of room to the left of Barack Obama. I consider myself to populate that space.
Right.
And so it's infuriating when I hear right-wingers and the corporate media people who just repeat their talking points without challenge repeatedly, you know, frame Obama as a dangerous leftist.
Right.
And so it makes it hard to really talk credibly or to communicate with people and really connect because the terms really have been spun to the point of being meaningless. And starting with the term liberal, going back to Ronald Reagan,
right.
He successfully demonized that so right. that it really is an epithet that carries no calories except hate. And
yeah.
And so how do we try to define terms for a discussion like this when whatever was the center has moved so far to the right? And the mainstream view of what the left is so skewed.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's really the fundamental point, and I have a lot of respect for you and people like you that are really out in the mass media and attempting to create a kind of rational public space in which we can talk about some of the problems that face us as a nation, because it is kind of a cacophony of conflicting noises. It is very hard. Some people have said to me, "Well, why do we need the term left? Maybe we should use a term like radical and so forth." And in the long run, I don't really, I'm not wedded to the particular term, but it's also very important not to back down. One man said to me, "Well, you know, the term left, you know, takes us back to communism and so forth." And that's something that we have to own up to. That's something we have to look at, not so much in America, but we have to look at that globally. We have to look at the problems of the past. We don't want to back down first in words and then we back down in principles. I think the only answer, I don't have really a good answer to your question, because, I mean, I think that is a fundamental problem. Whether we can really have a really serious, deep, probing question, discussion, about who we are as a nation and what direction we want to go in today's media climate. I don't really know the answer to that. But that's why I put the emphasis on leftists, what I call leftists, being able to talk to one another and starting to have a discourse amongst ourselves. And when I think of one of the things that I think people can learn from my book, all three of our previous lefts were in the same situation. I mean, the abolitionists were, you know, they were just the worst kind of minority. They were just hooted down and laughed at. And then, you know, when the Civil War came, they looked at one another and they said, my God, you know, everyone has now come around to our point of view. And it was really, in many ways, it was somewhat similar, really, with the socialists and the social democrats and the people who built the modern welfare state, really. And it was the same thing with the new left in the early 1960s. It was McCarthyism, mm-hmm. and the McCarthy period had completely destroyed the sense of history, and they started afresh. So it's not unusual. I mean, the left historically is a minority. It speaks to really crucial moments in American history. Whether we can do that today or not, I don't know.
And Professor, I would argue that some things have changed in an irretrievable way, and that, sure, we had press barons who could demagogue an issue previous to the invention of radio and television. But I had the dubious honor of spending several years on a radio station in San Francisco following the Rush Limbaugh program every day.
Yeah,
and I would attempt, and I had some success, to work with his so-called ditto heads who would call my program and who would be basically repeating talking points that they had heard from Limbaugh without thinking, without any fact-checking,
right.
And they would just lay these assertions on me, and I would hear them out and then say, well, I know that's what Rush thinks, but what do you think?
Right.
And that would typically silence them. But the incredible, maybe you are aware of this, but in talk radio, it's a 9-to-1 ratio of conservatives to non-conservatives. And
right.
non-conservatives includes a lot of people who don't talk about politics or who just cover local issues in a kind of nonpartisan way. So my question is, given the media landscape and the rise of the Fox News channel, which causes copycats on the part of other channels
right.
that are chasing Fox, is there even the potential for a new rise of the left in this country, given the way corporate influence, money in politics, and right-wing media domination make that very, very challenging?
Yeah, no, I mean, is there a potential? I would have to say yes. So much, in my view, so much depends upon it, because I do think that the United States is really in danger of becoming a second-rate nation in terms of the two-tier character of our society. Some people, you know, can buy education, can buy health care, can buy housing, can buy security. Other people, most people are frozen out and so forth. In terms of almost the kind of craziness of the public discourse, the constant wars, maybe getting slightly better under Obama, but still. So, is there a potential? There's a need. And I would also point, if you want to ask the question of, could it happen? I would really point to 2008, because in 2008, there was a very widespread consensus when Obama was running for the nomination that the kind of people and the kind of country that we had become under Bush and the policies that we were pursuing in Iraq and in terms of, you know, culminating in the financial crisis at home were disastrous for us, and that we needed to move in a new direction. And it does seem to me that had Obama, when he was elected, continued on that theme of moving the country in a new direction, we would have had a left to the left of Obama in dialogue with him, the same way we had a left that was in dialogue with, for a while, with Lyndon Johnson or John F. Kennedy, with Franklin Roosevelt, with Abraham Lincoln. These were not leftist figures, but they opened the path in which a left could function. So it's not up to the left alone, but is there a potential? I think there's a potential, but to say that, I'm wildly optimistic, I'm not.
Well, Professor, I would differ with you a bit in your characterization of Obama, because I don't believe he's been better about war.
Yeah.
You know, with the drone strikes, the targeted killing program,
no, I agree.
The involvement in Libya, an undeclared war in Yemen, and the way he has managed to marginalize critics.
Right.
And I coined the term Leflon. Reagan was called the Teflon president, and I believe that DuPont created a new and improved version for Obama so that nothing sticks to him from the left.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Those two articles in the New York Times about the cyber warfare and the drones said, you know, he just starts with this incredible, I mean, people think, you know, he won the Nobel Peace Prize and all of that before he, I basically agree with you.
Well, and I have one of these Obama hope stickers on my sliding glass door here.
Yeah.
And I'm looking to amend it to read, hope he doesn't put me on the kill list.
Yeah. No, that's just unbelievable, because habeas corpus, your right to have a trial, not to be killed by your king. This is the most fundamental basis of individual liberty that goes back to the Middle Ages, and that we have come under Obama to the point that the President of the United States, on his own say-so, can decide to assassinate an American citizen, as he has done, two that we know of, and that people are not outraged. It is really unbelievable. And in that environment, to call for a left perhaps sounds crazy, but who else is going to address the problems?
Well, and in the face of this targeted killing program, the people who pass for the left in Washington are elected leaders, are closing ranks to crack down on the leakers who expose this criminal behavior, but not to explore the crimes in any way.
Yeah, no, I actually think that the Obama, I mean, I don't know, I'm not an expert on this, but it's my sense that those articles came from the Obama campaign themselves, as the Republicans said. They did.
I share that speculation, yes.
Yeah, just in terms of Obama's reputation, my book is being translated into French. And they gave it a different title. The subtitle is, they call it, actually, they use the English term left as
right.
The title, but then they give it a subtitle, an autre gauche aux États-Unis, another left in the United States, and an essay on an autre gauche. And I said to them, what is this? I don't like this title, you know, and so forth. And they said, everybody in France thinks that Obama's the left in the United States, and what you're proposing, another left, a left something to the left of Obama.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm agreeing with you that, that to me was really the worst thing that about the Obama presidency was, under Bush, we had maybe not exactly a left, but a kind of, you know, a very strong anti-war sense and a very strong sense of how wrong the Bush presidency was. And that's all been dissipated because Obama has just sort of occupied that space, which is absolutely ridiculous. And he has moved further and further to the right because he hasn't had anything to fear from the left. And with him, the country has moved to the right. Of course, there were these right-wingers there. But we forget how weak they were in 2008.
We're talking with Eli Zaretsky, his new book, Why America Needs a Left. And, Professor, I'd like to ask you to take a couple of minutes here, as I referenced earlier. I was fascinated by some of the depth that you offer. And by the way, this is not a lengthy book, and it's not a dense academic book. I think it's very accessible. And
thank you.
You talk about, in addition to the Roosevelt New Deal, that most people, including liberals and Democrats, have a kind of narrow sense of. But there were many other movements and activities going on at that point. Socialists, communists, women's suffrage was a recent development. The prohibitionists were active in that period of time. And so I wonder if you would talk a little bit about the Popular Front, about those who supported ideas that we now deride as socialism and communism, but that were very powerful in the political conversation of the 1930s and 1940s.
Yeah. Well, what we call the Popular Front, the kind of left wing of the New Deal, the part of the New Deal that was pushing leftward, was a transformative force in American life. It produced what we call the modern middle class, the middle class that has now been largely destroyed, or what was then called the working class, the industrial working class. It brought the immigrants into American life. If you were born in Poland or in Russia or in Italy, and you had come to America as an immigrant, you were not even regarded as an American until the New Deal. Roosevelt was an amazing figure. I just read today that in 1942, Roosevelt agitated for a maximum income, 100% income tax on all incomes over, I think it was $325,000. So just as we have a minimum wage, he wanted to have a maximum wage. He didn't achieve it. But he understood what was core to the New Deal domestically was the realization, and I mean, Keynes makes this absolutely crystal clear, that you can't rely on markets alone. They can do some wonderful things, but they will produce long-term unemployment, long-term stagnation, long-term glut, that you need government, and you need government to guarantee basic necessities of life like health, education, housing, and jobs. You must periodically. You need a balance between government and markets. And then finally, I think what people don't realize, they think of the New Deal and then they think of World War II. A lot of people say the New Deal didn't end the Depression. World War II ended the Depression, as if World War II was something completely separate from the New Deal. It was a continuation. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that the United States really had a leading role in forging the anti-fascist coalition, the destruction of Nazism and the destruction of Japanese militarism, and the rebuilding of those nations as democratic nations after World War II. That was really a lot the result of American leadership, their cooperation, of course, with the Soviet Union, their cooperation with Free France and so forth. But in the 1930s, a lot of Europe moved to the right, but the United States moved to the left.
Mm-hmm. And there are two groups whose letters are well known by Americans living today, but the history and their impact, I think, are much diminished. One is the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which mm-hmm. is now just the last three letters of the AFL.
Right.
And the NAACP, the National right. Association for the Advancement of Colored People. You correctly point out that they had a significant role in organizing people around liberal or left policies in this period when Roosevelt was really the dominant factor, and he was really, at least with respect to these groups, a centrist.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, the CIO was based on the older union movement, the AFL, were organized craft unions, meaning you had to have a skill. So they had organized like the Carpenters Union or the Electricians Union and so forth. But the mass of workers were unskilled or semi-skilled. And so the CIO organized industrial unions, which meant they organized everybody in a union. Everybody in a particular industry into one union, like the Auto Workers Union, RUSA. That was a classic CIO union. This was a revolution in American life, because until then, the union movement was a kind of elite anti-immigrant movement, and they turned it into a pro-immigrant, very democratic movement that transformed the Democratic Party. In 1937, they launched the sit-down strikes, where they occupied, which is a predecessor of Occupy Wall Street. They occupied factories, and it inspired movements throughout the whole world in the same way that Occupy Wall Street has. People don't realize that the United States has had a leading role in inspiring left activity throughout the world, not communism, but other kinds of left activity. And these were wonderful events where they occupied the factories sometimes for weeks, and they never touched a piece of property. They wouldn't destroy anything, and the government protected them. So that's as far as the CIO goes. And as far as the NAACP goes, that was founded in 1909. Until the New Deal period, until the Popular Front period, it was a relatively conservative organization that was emphasizing sort of self-help for African Americans, pull yourself up by the bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
But under the impact of the New Deal and the kind of militancy of the Popular Front, in the sense that was being conveyed to ordinary people that they had the right, it was their country, and they had the right to these basic things, it became a very militant institution. The Supreme Court in the United States has always been a conservative institution, but Roosevelt got to appoint a whole bunch of new justices, and that created the Warren Court, which in 1954 integrated the schools and
right.
helped kick off the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's much more we could talk about. It's a fascinating book, Why America Needs a Left. And, Professor, will there be a sequel? Because I was a little disappointed you didn't get to Reagan, and in particular, Clinton. You kind of cut off around 1970 with some comments about the current situation in your conclusion.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, there will be a sequel.
All right.
And I'm working on it now, in which I try to characterize what is the contemporary crisis. In other words, the basic idea of the book is that America has to be understood as having a history of fundamental crises, which are turning points. One is the Civil War. One was the turning point that was associated with the New Deal. And one is the current crisis that we're in now, and the new left is part of that. And so I'm working on that now.
Okay. Well, I will look forward to that. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
Eli Zaretsky here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Now, as promised, San Francisco's stand-up comic and sit-down satirist Will Durst weighs in on campaign cash corruption.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a couple of words straight out of the middle of the campaign doldrums. And those words are money, money, money. We're in that lazy home stretch on the way to the national conventions, and the candidates are busier than sharks in shallow tuna-infested waters trying to raise a little bit of money. Maybe some more money. How about all the money? At this point, they're so omnifocused, you'd think they were being pursued by the hounds of fundraising hell. Well, maybe they are. In May, the president picked up $60 million versus $76 for the presumptive Republican nominee, and that was considered by most experts to be slack city, chump change. Must have been distracted, weren't really trying. But those were just random tips. Well, this is collection plate time, and both candidates are running large-scale donation mining operations, scouring the country for buried treasure, holding potential donors by the heels and shaking the change out of their pockets. It's a lot like a listening tour, but the only people being heard are those with big, fat, wide-open wallets. The two campaigns expect to raise $1 billion each by September, and that doesn't count the money being sucked up by the respective super PACs either. We can't blame the politicians. It was the Supreme Court that started this amazing race for cash when it judged money to be free speech. And the candidates are simply searching for the loudest voices. The human megaphones who can drown out everybody else at 50 paces. American Idol for shriekers. Then again, don't bother asking what these big-time donors get for their money, because we all know the difference between a campaign contribution and a bribe is nothing more than five syllables. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Well, thanks for being here with me. Sometimes gets a little lonely out here on the left, don't it? Email humblehost at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.